Hello, Les Raymond here with the Mindful Movement. Whether you are about to enjoy one of Sarah's beautiful meditations or dive into a podcast interview, I would like to remind our community that the best way to support the Mindful Movement is to support the companies that make this happen. Sarah and I are very picky about the companies we choose to work with, and we are grateful to have the relationships we have and to share them with our listeners. You can learn more about our affiliates through our website by clicking on the Favorites tab. We are excited to have recently added Sun Lighten as an affiliate. They make state-of-the-art infrared saunas, and their founder, Connie, came on for a recent interview if you would like to listen. Our Sun Lighten sauna has been a family favorite for over a decade. Some of our most popular affiliates are the Grounding Mats from Ultimate Longevity, which we sleep on every night, and the Apollo Neuro, which Sarah is now wearing daily to help manage stress. When you support these brands, you in turn are supporting the Mindful Movement and helping Sarah and I continue to devote our time to this passion. Whether you check out these companies or not, I just want to say thanks again and reiterate how grateful Sarah and I both are for all of the support over the years. I hope you enjoy the episode.
Hello and welcome to the Mindful Movement Podcast. I'm your host, Les Raymond. Thanks for joining me today for another episode. I am very grateful today. Mary Ruddick, the nutritionist, has come back onto the Mindful Movement Podcast. She was a guest not long ago where she kind of blew our minds with some nutritional info. She has just a tremendous story of healing that she has endured herself, and she's learned so many lessons through that journey. And she has found a gift in giving those lessons to others and helping them enable their healing. And that is her website, enableyourhealing.com. I definitely recommend you checking it out. Mary was nice enough to come back to help me personally deal with, I guess, a regression of my healing that I've experienced recently in order to allow the audience to kind of witness what that process looks like, at least a somewhat surface level. You could get very in-depth with going over all kinds of testing and lab work, but just from kind of the general, what do the symptoms look like, what's going on in your life, and then trying to navigate decisions based on that information from a place of experience and wisdom and a relentless desire to keep learning that Mary seems to present with. So this was a little challenging for me personally because honestly, I do get personal once in a while, but I really had to put myself out there. It required a bit of vulnerability that I haven't experienced lately to talk about symptoms I'm dealing with. Sometimes I feel like being, I guess, a health enthusiast and someone that helps others on their health journeys, it's almost as if it's a poor reflection on me when I'm not at my best. As if I can't heal myself, then what do I have to offer others? And psychologically and emotionally, that could be challenging for me to kind of admit and accept. But, we're all in this together, and I want to help others. And I know that if I continue to learn how to help myself, I could continue to help others. And Mary's role is just tremendous in that journey. I've worked with a lot of nutritionists over the years, and I feel like I've gotten useful bits and pieces from everyone. But, Mary is definitely someone special, and I'm excited to implement the things that she's recommended. Now, this is not medical advice, so even if you share like a similar symptom, that doesn't necessarily mean that what she's dishing out to me is what you should try. But then there may be more than one way to get from A to B. What's amazing is when you learn about Mary's work, she works with just a host of different conditions with a host of different medical diets. And it's really amazing what role that our diet and our nutrition can play in our healing. And I love the holistic approach that Mary takes where, it is kind of a lifestyle thing. It's not just the food, it's when you eat it, it's what you're doing in the morning, it's how much sunlight you're getting, it's what you're doing in the evening, it's how much, time of stillness or meditation you're getting. It's the temperature of your showers. I mean, it's really in depth. So I'm excited about following through with her recommendations. And I'm excited for her to come back after I've done that so I could share with you what that experience was like and, you know, what came out of it, and see if there's something to gain and something of value for you guys out there. So I just had a tremendous time talking to Mary again. I look forward to a long-lasting relationship where maybe she could just come back every once in a while to the channel and help us. So I appreciate you guys tuning in. I hope you enjoy this episode. And that's about it. All right. Mary Ruddick is back on the Mindful Movement podcast. I am so grateful, Mary, that you're here with me today. You were kind enough to really shed some really powerful insights maybe a few months back on the podcast, and it definitely resonated with a lot of our audience. And you offered up your services to kind of help me in real time navigate a health issue and kind of let the audience, I guess, witness the process and get an idea of what working with a qualified nutritionist even looks like, and maybe get to see the framework that you work within and how you navigate it. First, I guess, just say hello again to the audience.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me.
Mary is in what sounds like paradise now in South Africa, swimming with penguins and dolphins.
That's even sound real, but it's true.
It doesn't sound real, but I believe you.
Yeah.
So the audience has heard, I guess, bits and pieces of my health journey over the last few years. But you haven't really. You have very small data points. And frankly, I'm a little terrified of this process because this feels, I guess, very vulnerable putting, you know, generally I'm very like pro like individual freedom and like medical sovereignty and like what's going through your situation is kind of none of anyone else's business. And I am choosing to put my business out there in hopes that it helps other people. I know that I've made a lot of mistakes. I've learned a lot of lessons and gone through a lot of like trial and error, some of which was like really expensive, both time-wise, financially, and like all the physical regressions along the way of kind of bouncing around on a healing journey. And it means a lot to me if I can help someone maybe avoid some of those steps and have a more like productive linear approach to their healing, if that makes sense.
Yes, I am completely on board, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. Same reason.
I am so grateful that you're doing this. So maybe I could, would you like me to give, since you know very little bit about my background.
I know nothing except that you've had Lyme. I don't know how long you've had it. I don't know what you've tried. So we'll go through all of it. But first, before we start, I really want to commend you because even for me personally, I didn't talk about my health until long after remission. It's such a sensitive, tender spot in us when we're dealing with health issues, and it's very personal, and it's easy to awaken those emotions of vulnerability, of like, am I enough? Why can't I fix this? Why am I different? Why haven't I healed? So I think your bravery is beyond, actually, and really courageous. And feel free not to publish this if you want. Like, totally fine. But my goal is the same as yours. When I got through illness, I felt like people do not need to wait a decade to learn what I learned. And although, yes, we can look at all of our trials and tribulations as part of the journey, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have them? Yes. And I know for sure, you know, I did the same. I made many things, lots of costly things that didn't help. But for me, because I became a practitioner afterwards, they actually really were quite valuable because I learned what did and didn't work for certain things, at least in my own body, not to say that'll work for everyone. But I find with Lyme in particular, and we'll see if you have other things going on too, I find with Lyme, there's so much misunderstanding and miseducation outside of the veterinary field. The vets are very good with Lyme. Yeah, very good, because they can't blame it on placebo. right? They can't blame it on emotions or anything else. And so they're
Interesting.
very good, actually very good with autoimmunity as well. But with Lyme, I see a lot of people that just become skeletons of who they were over time. In many parts of America, the go-to treatment is typically IV antibiotics. And I just met the first person that I've ever seen that help. I've always said historically, like, I've never seen that help anyone. I've only seen that make people more weak, especially if it's not caught within the first month. Typically with Lyme, like if I was bitten by a tick, I like to give examples if it was me. So you know my genuine, like what I would do. If it was me and I was bit by a tick, especially in Lyme-rich territory, I actually, even given my history, I actually would do antibiotics if it was right then. If it was more than a month or even more than probably 2 weeks after the tick bite, I would not, because I just haven't seen it be effective. What I've seen be effective is more of working on the person's immune system, rebuilding the immune system, getting your own body strong enough, rebuilding the nervous system so you don't have that long-standing nervous system damage that you can get with Lyme. And then if you need to still treat it, using a few key herbs, but not before. The kill approach, I just don't see be too successful. You know, there's the rare birds out there that will respond to that. Most people will get more weak, and it's treatment after treatment after treatment, that can really just negate the healing process. So let's dive into you. So tell me, how long have you been dealing with health issues? When did they start?
Well, I guess let me give you a little background of my history so that even before that, so you can kind of see the foundation that I had going into the tick bite. Because I was really, like, I grew up on, you know, the standard American diet. You know, the my mom was aware enough to not give us, like, Fruit Loops, but it was, like, still, like, you know, like Frosted Christmas Flakes. Like, what? Yeah, rice, like, it wasn't a big difference. Or, but, you know, we had enough nutrition that we probably didn't have any major deficiencies. But, you know, we still ate junk. We didn't really know better. And then when I was a teenager, I got into, like, drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was like, I recall, like, the first time getting drunk at, like, Passover Seder at 8 years old, which, not an ideal thing for someone to experience. But when I was 15, I got introduced to alcohol and drugs for, like, recreational purposes. Mm-hmm. And I really fell in love with it. And I didn't know till long after, really till I quit alcohol, which I'm just past 5 years now, like, what I was really soothing, which was all, you know, pain. Like, I've heard it referenced that, like, people will point to a drug and say, you know, this is the gateway drug. Pain is the gateway drug.
Yes, it is.
You know, so, but, like, I just fell in love with it. So, like, I wouldn't like get wasted every night, but I would consume very regularly, but not like high amounts. But then eventually in adulthood, those amounts started to grow. I went through a little cocaine addiction for a few years, an opiate addiction, which really, I think, set the stage for kind of like a slower motility. If anybody's taken an opiate, it's like instant constipation. I don't understand the mechanism that, but it really just slows down the, I guess the, what is it? The migratory motor complex, the thing that makes your food come out the, you know, move through. And people, I don't think really know how important it is to not be constipated. And some people don't even really understand what it makes. Because, like, the medical definition of constipated is so intensely constipated. Like, there's such a broad spectrum of constipation that is constipation before you hit their criteria.
Yeah.
But so I have this, like, foundation of, you know, really putting a lot of insults into the body and probably creating a lot of oxidative damage and oxidative stress. Especially with the alcohol, because, you know, I would drink fairly regularly. I would say I drank almost every day
for 23 years.
Okay.
Really only getting drunk probably on the weekends, but having some consumption every day. So, you know, they say, you know, all, you know, your health kind of begins in the gut. It's kind of, I think, impossible to have a healthy gut if you're putting hard liquor in it every day. It even is. If it's a little bit, it's just, it's, you know, it's going to be hard to make healing progress. So I had that foundation, but then I started to change my lifestyle. So, you know, almost 20 years ago, started exercising, started to eat healthy food. Now, I was still doing like the drinking. I had basically quit opiates, quit cocaine a long time before that, wasn't using cannabis anymore. And really, I was still eating some junk food. Like I would have maybe a burger or pizza for lunch, but like I would have the salmon and rice and broccoli, what I thought to be like a really healthy, balanced meal for dinner. So I was starting to get nutrition and I was exercising. So that I went like that for a long time, fairly successfully, and made a lot of progress. I was racing, running races, foot races, triathlons. Dove pretty deep into triathlon and done about 35 triathlons over like a 7-year period, probably about 200 running races. So I was very active. And I was eating good things, but I was also still eating some bad things and still drinking. And then in 2017, so I quit drinking in 2016. In 2017, I was feeling great. I mean, I was exercising. I was sleeping enough, probably not as much as I could, but I was always willing to take like a power nap in the afternoon to kind of make up for a non-optimal night's sleep. And it seemed like that was enough for me to compensate my way through life pretty well. And I loved exercising outside. I live with meadows and woods, and I like being in them. Ticks live there. So one day, I know it was a Sunday. I know this is the day it happened because it was a Sunday, and I was in like bliss in the middle of my exercise in the sun. It's June in Maryland, which is like warm. It's just a beautiful time to be outside. I'm in the meadow, like running and doing some yoga, and like got the music in my ears, perfect day. And I lay down in the meadow and I'm just like loving life on top of the world. And I know there's ticks out there, but like I've decided to not live with fear at this time about them. And just, and like in this moment, this is just a perfect day for me. The next day, I'm in my car. So this is Monday. And I feel this like a sensation in my gut all of a sudden, as if a chemical had been injected into me. Mm-hmm. And I was like instantly like, oh, something's wrong. I feel sick. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know really, you know, I had no idea what it was. I had just taken a bite of lunch and I was like, was that food poisoning? But I remember it was like something that should be relatively benign. So it couldn't be that. And then progressively that week, I feel worse. And then I'm on a massage table that Thursday. And I still feel like crap. It's kind of like the flu, but without the fever. The massage therapist, I'm so grateful, I was on the table. She says, what happened to your leg? Did you get a bruise? And I knew right away, because I've heard about Lyme. I live in a kind of limey area.
Me too.
And yeah. I'm like, does it look like a bullseye? And she pauses for a moment and she says, yeah. And I like sprung up and here I am naked. So she got like really rare. And I'm like, I got to get to the emergency. Like I got to get to urgent care. I need to get antibiotics in me immediately. Like I have Lyme. I knew because I felt crap on Monday and it got progressively worse. And it was like, all right, this makes sense. And I've always in the back of my head, I think, been a little terrified of Lyme.
I think it's natural in that area.
Yeah, because you hear like everybody's got a freaking nightmarish story, which later I learn to shut people up. Because when you tell someone you've experienced Lyme and they want to tell you about their how their cousin, how it ruined their life, I'm like, I don't want to hear it. Like, I don't want the negative thoughts. I don't want it. But to come back, so I get in, so I go on the doxycycline, which is, you know, fairly broad spectrum antibiotic for 3 weeks. I think within a few days, the antibiotics pretty much knocked out the Lyme. Like all the things I was feeling up to that day, you know, they were gone probably by the third day of antibiotics. But then I had to continue taking them because that's what the doctor said. And I didn't really know. I think I would do it different now if I knew. And then I had this time where I'm on them and I have this opportunity to like, what do I do from here? Because some people are like, oh, you should be on it for 6 weeks or 6 months. And I'm like, well, that's crazy. So I found a Lyme literate nutritionist, an herbalist locally. And she recommended going from the doxycycline when I get off that to like herbal, like softer antimicrobials to keep chipping away, but maybe not something as harsh and powerful as the pharmaceutical.
Right.
And now I know like that's not so benign. Like those herbs are legit. So an antimicrobial herb is an antibiotic. It's nature's antibiotic. Like they don't come without a price also.
Absolutely.
So I did that for a while. And here for the last, like, I don't know, year or so going into this, I'm eating fairly paleo. So, you know, not a lot of like, oh, relatively just a whole food based diet, which later I've learned, you know, that also doesn't come without a price. Also, a lot of things that are thought of as being healthy. And I know we talked about this past. I've had Saladino on the podcast, like starting to understand plants, you know, have their poisons in them too. And for some people they could handle them pretty well. What I think is that if you've had a bunch of antibiotics, you're less likely to be able to handle them for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
So this nutritionist at the time recommends a few diets, one of them being ketosis to try just from like a healing perspective. I think she referred to one diet as like a mito diet, which just sounded like kind of like a, almost like just a whole 30 kind of somewhat restrictive, but paleo diet. And was feeling all right. And then like this rash started to develop. And it started as like this little piece of eczema that was the size of a dime on my leg. So this was November of 17. By February of 18, that rash had covered my entire body. And my doctor had one tool, which was steroid, oral steroid. He sent me to dermatologists. They had two tools, oral steroid and topical steroid. And anytime I would raise the question of like trying to inquire about a cause of this, it was just kind of a ridiculous response. Like, well, if you knew what caused eczema, you'd be a billionaire. Like, it was just like this cop-out almost. Like, we're not even gonna ask that question. And then luckily I got introduced to an integrative doc. And for those listening, integrative doc, I guess it's kind of the integration of Western models and Eastern models. They're open-minded. They're, you know, take a natural approach if they can, but they don't shy away from, you know, allopathic style pharmaceutical. And, you know, there's a time and place for everything. Like we're lucky to have all these tools and let's not rule any of them out. That's the general attitude I kind of perceive when I'm dealing with the integrative doc. So he does some tests and he says, and they're interesting tests. Like one was an eye exam that was testing, I think it's called a visual contrast screen. So it's testing kind of how the optic nerve
smart
can judge like contrast. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is strange, you know? And then a bunch of blood work. And there were a couple data points, one being the eye exam. He's like, you know, I think you have potential mold exposure. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how do you get that from here? Like, that doesn't make any sense. And now in hindsight, I've learned a lot of people that have Lyme have also, there's like a pretty strong connection between mold exposure and Lyme. Mm-hmm. So I call to get like a mold inspection of the house. Sure enough, freaking mold covered in our attic.
Okay.
And some other areas. So like right above the bedroom where I sleep, like there's just sheets of black in the... So that's an expensive process trying to get mold out of the house.
Wildly so, and stressful as well.
Super stressful. And keep in mind, this was already like, there was a lot of stress in my life, not just the getting Lyme, but like emotional stress. And I think people don't understand as much the connection of like emotional and mental stress to the physical stress, like especially family stress, financial stress, things that can trigger the nervous system and suppress your immune system.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of that at that time, which I know a lot of people would relate. And in hindsight, like I've heard so many stories of people with Lyme that they say like they got it. It was always like around a divorce, the loss of a loved one, or some really emotionally stressful thing, mm-hmm. which I find interesting. So turns out there's mold. So I do all this work and the mash doesn't get better. And I'm just treating it, putting like topical steroids. And, you know, he gives me this powerful steroid that basically says, don't use for more than 2 to 3 weeks. Well, I had to like, work for me. Cause if I didn't use it, like life was bad.
Yeah.
Like bad. I mean, like you can't leave the house. Like eczema of your body is kind of can really be debilitating.
Completely.
Your quality of life plummets, my ability to work like plummeted. And I was like, you know, physically weak. I mean, from someone that was doing, that could do probably a sprint triathlon on a day's notice, I went from like crawling from one end of a room to the other, would spike my heart rate to like 130, where it should be like 70. And I'd have to lay down and like rest for a few minutes to recover before I could crawl back. Just to put it in context of like, you know, how it was manifesting physically. So that was rough. So then I went through all these like different paths of trying to detoxify, I guess, biotoxins, mold related mycotoxins, possibly Lyme toxins. Like you don't really know what's affecting you. You know that when you go, I went on antibiotics. So all the good guys in my gut were like compromised. So anything that was like pathogenic or opportunistic, whether they're parasites or candida or whatever, like started to grow. So I went through all these like cleanse protocols and I moved a lot of stuff. Like they seemed really productive, but nothing really like fixed it for good. There were moments where it's like, oh, that definitely helps. And I've done some pretty wild detox things, whether they're coffee enemas, which at times I feel like have saved my life. And it was really embarrassing to mention that I've tried those. But when your doctor's like, you know, I know this is going to sound crazy, but, you know, people use these and they help. And you learn about, there's clinics out there in other countries that have protocols with these that save people's lives. So at this point, like I'm willing to try anything. And that's been a helpful tool. Epsom salt baths, very hopeful tool. The thing I probably rely on the most these days for kind of immediate relief. And in the back of my mind, going like learning all these things in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about this one other thing that I've heard reference, but it just seems like too much of a rabbit hole to go down, which is oxalates. Yeah. And the whole time, like I'm eating a, you know, quote unquote healthy diet, which turns out to be super high in oxalate. And my doctor says, you know, it could be that, but it's like, it's a never-ending rabbit hole that you're going to go down, and it might not be that. Mm-hmm. And like, I didn't really know how to handle that. Like, well, do you test for, and he didn't really, at the time, he didn't really know how to test for that. Now there's some reasonable tests for oxalates. And for the listeners, this is how I've learned oxalates, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, these are a plant toxin or poison. They don't really have a function in our physiology, and plants use them to hold on to minerals. And you know, if you've ever had a kidney stone, chances are it's a calcium oxalate stone. So they're involved in a lot of disease processes of the body, but the common thought is that they're just involved with kidney stones, but really they show up all over the place once you dig in and look at the research. Okay. But the general rule of thumb is you could move a decent amount of oxalates out of your body every day, but if you intake more than you can move out because it's poisonous, your body can't just have that poison floating around. So it has this elegant mechanism of hiding it and stashing it in tissues. And it could be organ tissues or whatever kind of tissues. And then when the concentration gradient changes, meaning when you stop intaking oxalates, your body will look at that as an opportunity to try to get rid of this stored poison. In that process, it is impossible, I guess, not to be exposed to that toxin, because it's got to go from a hiding place to getting out through either stool, urine, or through the skin. And maybe there's other ways, but from what I understand, those are basically the main.
Skin is very common.
So, and that could feel like shit. And they call that oxalate dumping. So at some point about a year ago, like I was, and before I really went down that rabbit hole, I was feeling better. And I had done a bunch of different things and I don't know what helped. And I could go over like the collection of things I've done maybe, but I was like 95% better. Like it was a miracle for about 6 months. Which gives me hope now, because I'm like, oh man, I've healed from this before. I could do it again. And then come August, September, or maybe October, it started to ramp up again. This is October 2020. And now I'm like back in a regression. And I've learned a ton about oxalates. I've listened to a ton of people that have gone through healing journeys. And it sounds like it could kind of go in waves, this dumping phenomenon. As you eat more, your body will stop dumping because the gradient, the concentration gradient will be more equalized or whatever, or the dumping will slow down so you don't have as much of an immunological reaction. And that's what the skin flares are, immunological reactions. So navigating this now, where you have somebody saying, if you want to not be affected by the poison, you have to eat more poison, essentially. It's really hard for me to grasp that idea. They're saying you need to eat more oxalates to slow down your dumping. And I'm like, well, I know this thing.
But it can be necessary because you can get into a dangerous state with oxalate dumping. It's not common, but if you have a history of kidney disease or seizures, which seizures are honestly pretty common in Lyme. I was one of these. I was a seizure person with kidney disease. And for folks like myself, you can get into a state of true acidosis. If you're dumping too many oxalates at once and they're binding to the electrolytes, it can change the pH of your blood to a dangerous level. That's not common, and you can remedy at home usually with some baking soda and water. That's what they'll do at the hospital as well. Not a bad idea to go, but
And that's to add bicarbonate.
That's right.
To buffer the acid.
Yes.
That's interesting you say that, because I've done some like, would that show up with acidic urine?
No, it's the
or
blood.
Or just blood, okay.
The blood, that's the most important. The urine, you'll know you're dumping if you have foam in the urine or cloudiness. A sign for those of us that go into the dangerous aspect, and again, it's a small portion. It's not something to be afraid of. It's just something to know about, is that when you're walking across the room, you get very breathless. That's a sign of acidosis in the blood. So it's not a normal breathlessness. It's very different. And you're more dizzy than usual. I know most people with Lyme have dysautonomia, but you will notice it is a different thing.
So that's is that because it's creating like hypoxia?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that's different than dysautonomia, which is basically dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system, which can also create breathlessness.
Yes. And so there are things you can do with oxalates that bind. I really, having had a pretty heavy oxalate issue, and it runs in my family as well, I think we probably haven't had the bacteria that break it down for some time. So having had a pretty hefty load, I honestly don't have the doom and gloom view that a lot of people do with oxalates. I don't see it as a terrible thing to get through at all. I know it can make you uncomfortable at times, but a lot of times if you do certain tricks, like if you're on the carnivore diet, you'll know you're dumping too many oxalates if you have the liquid stools. That's a big sign. And that may not be appropriate for you. You may need to do more of like a GAPS ketogenic diet instead. It's different for each person what they need to do. But you can also do little tricks.
So you're saying liquid stools
are a sign of oxalate dumping.
Okay, because not to get... the point of this is getting personal to help others. So,
absolutely.
A history of constipation, but then I'll switch to loose stools, and it's almost like a sandy diarrhea, as if and on the like oxalate forms. And for those that want to learn more about oxalates, there's a Facebook group called Trying Low Oxalates
that is
an outstanding resource. The moderators are veterans, they're sharp, they're research based, and it's a very supportive group. There's going to be quack jobs on it, just like in any Facebook group. But for the most part, it's an outstanding resource. And that is a common thing that I've heard. That's been another data point for me, where you can't go, and then all of a sudden you go, and it's not a normal type of go.
So let's talk about that, because you know, you had mentioned the constipation earlier, and the problem when you don't have stools, you know, a lot of times people on medical diets, they won't have stools and they'll be like, well, I'm not bloated, I'm not in pain, so it's okay. And it's easy to think that, but once you get deeper into the microbiome, you start to realize it's still an issue, because there are bacteria that live in the colon that if your stool is in your colon for more than 2 days, it will start eating your stool. And here's the problem with that. That bacteria is byproduct. So basically they're toxins from the digestive process, inhibit the migratory motor complex, keep you from having stools, and can actually make you chronically constipated. Mm. Now, one of the things that's a huge issue with most people with chronic illness is that their detox channels aren't working great in the liver, right? Maybe phase 2, maybe phase 3, these kind of things. So they're just holding onto toxins, very common for bile issues, right? This constipation and diarrhea, or just diarrhea, or liquid stools, which I wouldn't consider diarrhea if it's once a day, right? So if it's the liquid stools kind of thing. And the bile is important to understand. I see so many people taking bile salts and trying to remedy this with bitter herbs and these kind of things, but it's often a sign that the body is overly toxic. So the body, our toxins are fat soluble. Toxins typically stay in the fat cells, and the fat cells, and the nervous system is primarily fat. So is the brain and the hair follicles, which is why a lot of people lose hair while they're sick. The toxins will go to those areas and cause damage in those areas. Now, we recirculate about 95% of our bile over and over. And so with our bile recirculation, we're recirculating our toxins. We're not getting rid of them.
And we so do that, I'm sorry to cut you off. We do that, from what I understand, because bile is kind of expensive to make.
So expensive, it's exhausting.
So we yeah. Recycle it, which if we weren't in a toxic environment, might not be that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm. That would be great, actually. Yeah.
But now that we have kind of just everybody has kind of more exposure to toxins than we would like, that recirculating is kind of stirring toxins up.
That's right. And so you can get that bile dumping that you're experiencing, or that some people do, or you can get the oxalate dumping, which a telltale sign is sandy stools, right? It looks like there's sand in your stools is pretty typical. Circulating back to what you were saying in the beginning about how, you know, emotions can really affect people, and you've seen a lot of people that have fallen ill during a divorce, these kind of things. Any kind of stress can tip us over. Most of us are walking on a cliff health-wise, and we don't know there's a cliff there. And so if you get any of kind of the four toxins come in, that could be pharmaceutical toxin, it can be environmental toxin, it can be emotional toxin, it can be lifestyle toxin, like shift work, lack of sleep. Any of those can tip you off into illness. And that's really all it takes. And if you have a combination, then you're really in trouble. And most of us have a combination these days. So it's not uncommon, and it's not psychosomatic. It's not, someone freaking themselves out into illness. It's very much that the body can't recover when it's under that much stress, both physical and emotional. And the microbes like Lyme, that's a huge stress on the body.
Right.
Yeah.
That's really, so not to get, well, to get graphic, the sandy stool, what is that? Is that oxalate actually binding to our minerals, to our electrolytes, and just creating a crystal essentially and coming out?
That's correct. So a lot of people ask why they require so much magnesium or these kind of things. And it's because if they have an oxalate issue, not everyone will, but if they have an oxalate issue, the oxalates are going to bind to the electrolytes and pull them out of the body. They don't dissolve in the body. We can't break them down. They're a very efficient toxin, and they're just little crystals. And like with all toxins, humans can tolerate a certain level. It's that you get past a threshold and you can't. And most of us, I know I made the same mistake. I ate way too many high oxalate foods when I started to try to eat healthy, because I was doing all these spinach salads and spinach smoothies and kale smoothies. I think most of us fall into this trap, but then it can really put a lot of stress on our detox organs. And so you'll start seeing some of these like terrible rashes. And that's not to say that all rashes are oxalate related. They're right. Not, but it's a common thing for someone to have if they have an oxalate issue.
And I did finally get the tests not long ago, because I actually worked with a nutritionist. Uh-huh. Unfortunately, it wasn't you. And she just insisted, It's not oxalate. And I'm just like scratching my head, like, I feel like I rolled everything out else out. And so I got the test. I think it's through a company called, it's a oat test, organic.
Yeah, the oats test is great. It'll tell you.
Yeah. So, and sure enough, it was high. And I sent it to my doc and he's like, well, there you go. There's your answer. Like, I'm like, all right, well, now it feels kind of great to have a more defined, I don't want to say enemy, but
understand.
But yes. But now, like, navigating this is challenging. And what I'm hoping is that the years of rash I had was like me moving a large percentage out, and it should get easier and easier as I go forward. Even if I have waves of dumping, hopefully it's not as bad or as long lasting.
Yeah. I'll tell you, you know, I had a big oxalate issue, but it wasn't a big deal for me like it is for so many. And that's not because I'm special. I just happened to be doing a lot of right things without knowing I was. I didn't know what I was doing. Honestly, I didn't. I knew I was supposed to eat less oxalate foods, but what I did was I went into a real ketogenic diet. So I went into 80% for a different reason, for a different health condition. And when you do that, that automatically limits how many oxalate foods you're consuming.
Right.
So I actually started eating berries again on that diet and nuts, but my portion sizes were just tiny and it wasn't an issue. And then for another health issue, I was taking magnesium citrate every day, for it. I don't have to take anything anymore, but it was very important then. And magnesium citrate, all the citrate forms bind to the oxalates and make it a lot easier. So between those two things, it gave my body an easier time. And I didn't have that nightmare story that so many people do. But a lot of times, typically, if you're having the symptoms from oxalates, you can slow it down, absolutely, through, if you're not eating any fibers, you can use lemon juice, but do not do that if you're eating vegetables. There's a reason for that. We don't need to go into the biochemistry here, but that's important. And then if you are eating vegetables and other foods, then you can, or plant matter, then you can do magnesium or calcium citrate. I usually use magnesium citrate if someone has constipation and calcium citrate if someone is having diarrhea, and maybe a mix of that if it's back and forth. Just depends, we go by the stools. And potassium citrate works too.
I'm sorry, what about like dosing? And keep in mind, Oz, that this is not medical advice. Please
for
don't
anyone
take this
out there.
This is just... showing the audience, you know, potential framework of like how to ask questions and one way of dancing the dance. It's not, and everybody's dance is going to be different.
Yeah, this is not for everyone.
But like one thing that's common in, I guess, the forums, like that a lot of people benefit from magnesium citrate, but I noticed the dosing's kind of all over the place. And What kind of dose was working for you, at least?
You know, I always tell people, and for myself, to bowel tolerance. You do it to where you don't have diarrhea, basically. Okay. So it's going to be a completely different dose for each person. And, you know, I've found, and this may just be correlation, this may not be fact, so I don't know, but I've found most oxalate people require an enormous amount of magnesium. And what's underlying that is typically a thiamine deficiency. When you have a thiamine deficiency, you can't hold on to magnesium. And I see that a lot.
Do you know why that is?
Correlation. Well, there's a lot of reasons. B1 is quick to go, and we don't have much of it in our diets in general. So like, for instance, you would have to eat about 6 ounces of pork meat a day, not the fat, the actual meat. It's not in bacon. And to get your RDA, there's not really many other foods that have it. Not too many people do that. So when you don't have enough of that one, you get into real trouble, because the other B vitamins, like, I haven't looked at your blood work, but let's say you tested less with like a B6 deficiency, which is common in Lyme, because that comes with the neuropathy and that kind of thing that you can get later on down the road, which we haven't even crossed into yet, but we will, to see if you're dealing with any of that. But if you show on any tests, whether it's like a spectra cell within the cell, which is a more important test than a serum test for vitamins, that you're deficient in one of the other B vitamins, it's really a very big sign that you're critically low in B1. B1 is used, it's not by definition an enzyme, but it's used like an enzyme for all the other B vitamins for their absorption and their use in the body. And so, you know, if you're low in the other ones, you're very low in the B1, even if it's not showing. And when you're low in that, then you get the magnesium deficiency and you switch. Well, basically you switch into the lactic acid cycle of energy, which is very common with oxalates, and that can put you into acidosis, which we were discussing earlier.
So you need thiamine to stay out of that cycle. Does that, you feel, can that trigger more oxalate dumping by bringing things kind of back online?
I haven't seen that. So, so with thiamine, one thing I want to definitely say, with Lyme and with dysautonomia and the nervous system conditions associated, chronic fatigue syndrome, all these kinds of things, the regular thiamine doesn't work. I haven't seen it work. You really,
when you say regular, you're referring to thiamine hydrochloride, the salt.
That's correct. Yeah, maybe it will for someone, but I've just never seen it work. So I always use the fat soluble forms. If someone has a sulfur intolerance, which we'll get into with you, we'll see if you're dealing with any of that. Then we go for the benfothiamine, and we go really high dose, sometimes up to like 2 grams. So we'll see if you need any of this. Yeah, it's serious, but it's very helpful.
I've heard a doctor speak about this.
Yeah.
I'm going to hopefully I don't bite.
It's one of the few vitamins.
Derek Longdale, or somebody that devoted like a lot of time. I think it was at either the Cleveland Clinic or Mayo Clinic or something.
A wonderful physician.
Yeah.
Yeah. And his work is fantastic. If anyone, you don't have brain fog, you can dive into it. It's pretty, yeah, because it's pretty heady. He did not write for the layperson, but he did wonderful work in reversing nervous system conditions with thiamine IVs. And it's really quite effective, but the form is very important. So if you, like Les, if you feel that like, I can't feeling, like I can't do this, I can't do that, that's very much a thiamine deficiency. Typically, that's how it presents with like, I couldn't possibly, not in a victim way, not in an archetype way, in a physical way. Gotcha. Like when you were crawling across the floor, and, right? And
for the audience, just, mm-hmm. you know, it's, I'm always baffled by how much the absolute basics go overlooked. This is B1. It's like the first vitamin that was discovered.
So
like,
important.
And vitamin comes from what, if I recall, the words like vital, ammy. It's vital. Like it's vital for life. You can't live. Like a deficiency in any one of them will result to an earlier death. They are important.
And also quality of life. Like most people with Lyme, I'm sure you are there as well, or at least have been. You don't feel like life is worth living. It's the quality goes down so high. Or so low.
It really did. Yeah. Now I feel great. Like,
yeah,
I feel freaking fantastic. Like I have all the lifestyle things in line.
Yeah.
I do 2.5 hour workouts twice a week, hour and a half workouts almost every other day. It's just, I can't control this like immune overreaction or something that shows that's manifested in like skin goings on, you know, skin things. But like my energy feels great, body composition feels good. It's like I could do, you know, I could pick up a few hundred pounds, I could do a bunch of pull-ups, I could run fast, like I feel good. And it makes it kind of hard, it makes me like kind of scratch my head, like what am I missing? The thiamine's interesting. I think because when I learned about that, I guess we need it to deal with carbohydrates and fat.
Yeah, carbohydrates more.
So you deplete it if you eat a lot of carbohydrates. So if you grow up on the standard American diet, you're probably going into adulthood deficient.
Yeah. And then typically when people get sick, I was in this camp, you start to go towards easier foods, quicker foods, which further deplete the B1. So, you know, people with chronic fatigue syndrome, they've really shown in studies that they don't use glucose for energy appropriately. And part of that is from that B1 conversion and use of energy in the ATP energy system. It's just not working. It's completely broken. So those people really have to shift into ketosis. That's their only other option. And some people aren't able to transition protein into carbohydrates. Not all bodies can do that. So going like a lean Atkins can make some people more sick. But yeah, the B1 is used whether you're converting fat or carbohydrates, but you use many more times when you're converting carbohydrates for energy as opposed to fat. So you can still get a deficiency or a deeper deficiency, but it's very slow as opposed to very rapid.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and you mentioned different forms. So I've heard these mentions, there's the salt, the hydrochloride, which I guess is cheap, which is in most multivitamins so forth.
Yeah. And I don't use multivitamins. I'm not much of a vitamin person, period.
Okay.
But yes. Mm-hmm.
But then you mentioned I don't know how to say it. What was the form?
Yes, that's right. That's a fat soluble form. So it's an odd B vitamin in that it has to be taken with some fat, and also all thiamine if we're working on the nerves of the brain in particular. So I'll usually do a mix of the two with people. And sometimes we'll just work up to 2000 milligrams, which is 2 grams, and we'll get to a great spot before that. So the person's feeling great, so we won't keep going, but we push for the two otherwise. And with that, magnesium is very important. You have to have both at the same time. But let's dive into, I want to hear how you are on a daily basis now. I'm intrigued by your ability to work out. So on your daily basis, what are your symptoms? What does it feel like to be you when you wake up? And
okay, so lately, I mean, I generally will wake up in the middle of the night with a histamine reaction lately. Okay. Meaning, and that shows up with just itch. Like, I don't know how to say it. It's just, you just wake up and I'm wired. Like 3 a.m, get up and my skin itches and I have an insane amount of energy. All I want to do is sleep and I feel like I could go sprint.
Okay.
Like it's weird. And then I've worked in some processes of things that could help. So if it's like really bad, I will take an Epsom salt bath in the middle of the night. I've tried to switch my mindset to a more positive thing and create like a really some me time out of it. Like this is my spiritual practice. I'm maybe gonna take a hit of cannabis, mm-hmm. take a bath, do breath work, meditate. Maybe an idea will just arise. It makes for good content for our listeners. Maybe a mindfulness tip. A lot of my mindfulness tips have come out of me just being in an emotional shitstorm and spending an hour like making space for healing, and then just something will come spontaneous. It's amazing how much good things have come from like pain along the way. But then there's times where I'll get up and like this morning I get up, it was like 2:30, you know, scratch a little bit, just can't resist. But then like, I'm able to just breathe, slow myself down and get back to bed. I've played with different things like melatonin or GABA or tryptophan or other things to help with the sleep. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Definitely used CBD a good bit, and that's been helpful. But nothing seems to help me just make it through the night. And then when I wake up, if I do fall back asleep, maybe I'm up for like 30 minutes to an hour. I fall back asleep. When I wake up at like Sarah's alarm usually goes off at 5:30. You know, within, it doesn't take long before I start to just itch again. So like every morning and every night, I seem to have this elevated histamine response. The middle of the day, I seem fine. It's really suppressed. So there's some kind of like circadian rhythm to the histamine. And I know histamine is naturally going to be higher in the morning because it's there to help wake you up and get you moving. It's just that because my bucket's so full, I guess, it pushes me over and it's not just waking me up, it's creating an itch and it's really hard.
Let me ask you some questions.
Yeah, go for it.
When you take your Epsom salt baths, are they hot?
They are hot. And I've found that sweating in general helps. So whether it's sauna or it's a hot bath, it doesn't help at first, like the first 5 minutes as my body's adjusting. As I begin to sweat, I have a histamine response, but it usually lasts for maybe 5 minutes. And then it's much better coming out of it. So like, whether it's a sauna, whether it's a bath, I always feel better afterwards, 100% of the time. But I might have a tough 5 minutes as I begin to sweat.
Is your body dry for that 5 minutes? Has it started sweating?
Is there, it's like when the sweat begins. So even if I'm exercising, like yesterday I exercised outside in Maryland, we got a nice warm spell here. And like, as I start to sweat in the sun, lifting weights, like, it's itchy. But then once I sweat for a few minutes, it's as if a layer of toxins have gotten out and my body gets happy.
Okay. I have to ask you a very personal question, which you're welcome to edit afterwards. But after both working out and after intercourse, do you feel better or worse?
Ooh, that's interesting. Sometimes I feel, if I do a lot of exercise, sometimes I do feel, and I've wondered if it's the acid, like the acidosis thing, like sometimes I do feel like that's too much. Like maybe it's just too much oxidative stress or something, even though I might feel good, my symptoms might have a negative reaction. Possibly with sex too.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Cause it's like stressful, but it's a different type. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an exciting stress. Yeah. What about, it's a happy stress.
I love that stress.
Yeah, it's a great stress, a healthy stress. What about traveling? Have you been on a plane in the last year and how did you feel?
I've been on a plane, didn't notice a problem from that.
Okay, so I think, and I could be wrong, I'm not looking at blood tests, but I think you could have histamines because histamines are common when you have microbial dysfunction. You're going to have some issues with it. I don't think it's a primary issue for you or a major issue. I think we can actually almost ignore it because most of what you're showing is actually quite different. High histamine would feel horrific after a bath. When they wake up in the middle of the night with the itching, they would be exhausted. They wouldn't be energetic. And you would feel much worse after exercise. I think what you're potentially looking at, potentially, is more parasitic in nature. Usually parasites work at night. They're nocturnal. And so when you have symptoms just at night, like that itching that you're getting, that's a clue that you want to look in that direction. And that's pretty common. We like to think that we have this sterile environment, but we just don't. Parasites are actually very common. Right. And they're not something to be afraid of. They're, you know, they're just as common as little bacterial overgrowths. And they just happen to have parties at night. So when you have a symptom at night, like itching, it can be a big sign that that's what's going on. And an Epsom salt bath or a bath would make you feel much better with parasites, whereas it would make you feel worse with histamine. Same as sauna. Sauna would make you feel much worse. So it's more likely that we're looking there, and that wouldn't be surprising, you know, whether it came with the tick or not, because there's so many co-infections that come with ticks that aren't Lyme, or if it's just something that you already had in your body and the antibiotics or the stress of the illness allowed it to overgrow a bit. That's where I would look. Especially since sweating really helps. Oh, one thing I didn't ask though is what about anxiety? Do you have anxiety?
Yeah, I mean, at times I experience anxiety, sure. Yeah, I mean, not as much as I used to. I mean, I went through a phase of like panic attacks and stuff, but that was a long time ago. But I guess I have anxiety around my symptoms.
Oh, sure. That's just Pavlovian. Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, this past year has been stressful. Like, I don't know anybody that doesn't experience anxiety at some time. Yeah. So, yeah.
It sounds like, especially in America, I honestly didn't have a clue as to how stressful it was until two of my friends came to visit. It's much more lax in other countries, despite even, you know, more quarantine. It's not as stressful in terms of like shaming or social issues.
Oh, like, man, there's a lot of weird shaming going on.
I had no idea.
It's definitely an ugly side of the human condition.
It's so human. Yes, it is so human. So I think what we want to look at for you is lactic acid more, because lactic acid, anytime you have, the reason why I was asking about anxiety is because very often histamine disorders can be misdiagnosed as anxiety or depression. It can present that way. But the way that you're explaining it fits really more with lactic acid instead. You can't have a panic attack without a high level of lactic acid in the body. So I think we want to look at your lactic acid. Now, I want to back up to when you were a child and when you were growing up. A lot of times, and again, I can't say for sure if this is your case, but this is pretty common and you'll know. A lot of times when we go through puberty, it's a huge stress on the body in the modern day. It, olden times in the tribes that I visit with, it's not. But for us, it is because we already have a lot of stressors going. And so when you bring in puberty, it can kind of tip you over that cliff that I was talking about. A lot of people, just due to living today, aren't making all their feel-good chemicals. And so when they go through puberty, they really have a difficulty making them. And what I usually see in teenagers is that they either go towards adventure sports to force produce it, because when you jump off a cliff or you go mountain biking, it forces a huge fountain of feel-good chemicals to be produced. Or they go to drugs and alcohol instead. So I bet you had a microbiome imbalance all the way back then. And so when then you had all the alcohol, you had the drugs, which honestly is normal for many parts of the country and or the world, really. I'm in South Africa and people drink all the time. It's like a lot for me as an American, but it's normal for their culture. So then you bring that in, and what alcohol does is it depletes nutrients, especially B vitamins, and the B vitamins protect your energy and they protect your nervous system, right? So you had this kind of setup, and then all along you start training for triathlons, which is very common with Lymies, and many people that get chronic fatigue syndrome because the training for that, even though it feels great, and I was one of these too. I was training for Ironman when I got sick. It's common because you're working out 2-3 hours a day. It's a huge stress. It's a beneficial stress, but it's a stress. Right. So you've got that stress plus modern living, plus the modern diet, and then you throw on Lyme, an infection, and your body just crumbles, right? And you likely had all those B deficiencies, so your nervous system wasn't very protected either. So that kind of is just like a little perfect storm, a rebuildable storm, like something that you
rebuildable. Thank you for that.
Absolutely. 100% rebuildable. Yes, we are very resilient. The body just needs some certain things that it's often not given. Once it's given, the body takes care of it for us. So you can always come back from this. But yeah, I think you probably weren't producing those things. And then what you mentioned about the opiates is very profound and something people should know, because a lot of people go through surgery. Like I had knee surgery a year ago to correct some ligaments that I had torn. And you're often prescribed these pain medicines that are opiates. But what those do is completely annihilate your serotonin in the body. So you'll get someone who's an active athlete who goes through maybe an ACL surgery, and they won't get depressed. It often doesn't present as depression. It'll present as either lack of will. So if you had someone with a strong character beforehand, and now they're like, I don't know why, but I cannot motivate myself to do this or that. That's low serotonin from the opioids, or it can cause constipation. Or it can cause migraines and headaches. Many, many headaches and migraines are caused from low serotonin, and it won't always present with depression. In fact, it often doesn't. So those are all things that I think are likely part of your picture as well. Now, one thing we want to look at is getting at your skin. So it sounds like your skin, your oxalates, your stool frequency are your main symptoms now. Is that correct?
Yeah, the skin is by far the main symptom.
Okay. And your sleep, of course. Okay. I'm going to tell you some things that you may not like, but I'm going to tell you anyway, and they might not even be right, but I would try them. Okay. Although you can work out to the level that you're tolerating, I think it's too big of a stress on your body. In general, when you're recovering, even though it's so exciting, when you get your energy back and you can really like lift things and run and do all these great things, you want to save that energy for healing. Healing requires an enormous amount of energy. So you can still do activities and you can have like an organized workout, but it needs to be pretty minimal. It needs to be like 40 minutes of biking or like going for a swim or going for a hike or a walk, very low cortisol activities. Because when you overproduce cortisol, as you do in a workout, Your liver's got to clear that out. And if your liver is busy clearing out the cortisol, it's not going to get to the other imbalanced hormones and toxins and everything else. You're just going to keep circulating those toxins. And it's going to be difficult to get past that last hurdle to full remission, right? Where you don't have any symptoms. So I would tone down the workouts a bit. The sleep, I would do a couple of things. Have you tried anything like Seraphos, PS100, phosphatidylserine, anything like that for sleep?
PS100 that I have tried a long time ago. I don't really remember it moving the needle. But
it probably won't then. I would, if it were me, and it's not something you have to do because I know you've looked at a lot of things, you might want to look at like a mild parasitic protocol, something like wormwood. That's not as strong as some of the other things.
I've done a bunch of parasite cleanses that seem to definitely move parasites.
Yeah.
But they don't have like lasting effects. I don't know if it's because I wasn't able to like rebuild the microbiome after, or
two questions with that.
Sure.
One, did your practitioners have you take the antiparasitic once a week long term, like still to today?
Once a week long term, no.
Very important. When you've had chronic parasitic infections, especially if you've seen them, because honestly, most parasites are not visual to the eye. 70% of them are microscopic. But the parasites, their egg can rehatch very easily. So it's a good idea to just take a small amount once a week. It can be something like mugwort tea. It doesn't have to be capsules and all of that.
It's interesting you mentioned the parasites because I've definitely noticed around moon cycles.
Ah, there's your answer.
And I've read that before that they're more, I guess, active. Yes. Around full and new moons?
They mate around the full moon. So whenever parasites can be really difficult to kill, to be honest. And a lot of that, I think, is because people don't work on their immune system first. If you work on your immune system, just like with Lyme, it's not as hard. It's pretty simple. But they're tricky little buggers because they rarely go to the digestive system. Like there's pulmonite, which is a parasite that's closely associated, we don't know if it's just correlation, with CFS that constantly goes from the liver to the lungs, never goes through the digestive system, except at the full moon when it goes to the duodenum to mate. And that's typically when it will go there, all the parasites. So it's the one time you can get the parasites that are maybe like liver flukes and those kind of things. But I would only do that if you've been off starch and on a microbiome building diet for 3 to 6 months. There's no point in treating before that, really.
Wait, can you say that again? So before treating for parasites, you're saying remove starch.
Yes, completely. How long have you been off starch before?
I don't know if I've ever made it more than like a week or two being like legit no starch. It's freaking hard.
This is what we're going
to
do.
I mean, I live with other people and I have to, and I'm doing the cooking. So yeah. Like when you're feeding a house full of people, it's hard to say, you can't say you guys can't have starch, and it's hard to give them starch and not have a bite.
Yes. So you have to decide which one you're going to do. You either need to not cook it for anyone or make something that you don't like. What I usually recommend to people is
that's brilliant.
Make something you don't actually like. Like maybe you don't care about white rice. So you can make them white rice every night, right? Because it's not going to be tempting, but you want to do something like that. So what I'm going to do.
Is ice cream a starch? Mm-hmm. Does ice cream count as starch?
No, but you can't have ice cream.
Can't have ice cream. And you're sure about that? Can we revisit this ice cream question like 100 times and see if you change your answer?
This is what I can tell you. My goal is to get you less to where you have zero symptoms and you don't have to be on a diet, right? Okay. So we need to put you on one for now so that we can get you better. But it's a arrow and bow approach. I'm going to pull you back for a period of time. It's not forever. Okay. I'm going to get you to where you're, at least this is my goal for you, is to get you where your microbiome is balanced to where you can eat things like rice and sourdough bread and not be sick. right? Okay. It's then feeding the good bacteria instead of the pathogenic. But to do that, you really have to avoid it. And I wouldn't bother with any supplements really until you fix that part, because that's your foundation. Okay. And that's also what prevents you from being in this situation again, right? I want you to be able to travel and lay in grass without fear, not just on a psychological level, but also on a real solid, my body is strong level, right?
I like the sound of that.
So it's necessary. So I'm going to send you a protocol that you're going to follow. I'm going to follow up with you on this.
Okay.
You can give the household like corn or rice or whatever it is that you don't care about. I want you to feel like maybe taro. I don't know. Pick one. And we're going to do this for 3 months, and we're going to clear this out, because when you have skin issues, you're looking at toxicity. Eczema is not a tricky thing to get at. It can be mercurial. So different things will work for different people with it. Like, for instance, my brother, he's had eczema since we were kids, and the terrible kind, the bleeding kind. And I put him on the GAPS diet, and it was gone in 7 days. And wow. It was all over his body. It's always been an issue. Outside of that, though, he was healthy. It hasn't come back. That's odd. That's not normal. I have patients that have the complete opposite experience. Other people, they have to look at histamines. Some people, it's a toxicity issue. So that the more detoxing, the better they feel, right? You are definitely in that camp. I want you sweating as much as possible. So more saunas, more Epsom salt baths, all of that. But eczema is also something that once it bleeds, once you have little tears in the skin from itching it and that kind of thing, then you're dealing with a secondary thing, which is a little bacterial infection. So baking soda in your bath can be really helpful with that, or a seaweed bath, or a honey and seaweed wrap can be really helpful. But whenever I see someone with a skin issue, I know it can get worse before it gets better. My brother's experience is rare, mainly because the skin is a big detox organ, right? And when you're healing, what you're doing is shifting the microbiome. So these bacteria, as they die off, they're releasing toxins, and those toxins are going to go through your main system. I'm a kidney detoxer. I tend to go through my kidneys, probably why I had kidney disease, right? And issues of the oxalates. Other people I work with are colon detoxers. Others are skin, but it's going to go through one or more of the detox organs is what's going to happen. So ideally, if you already know you're a skin person, it can get worse before it gets better. I don't want to paint a pretty picture. It really can. I don't think it will with you, because it would be getting worse already with your detox baths and saunas and things like that. So I really don't anticipate that with you. But I would look at not just oxalates for your rash, I would look at overall detox. You seem to be very rewarded by exercise, by saunas, by baths. So I would amplify that as much as possible. Okay. For me, when I was going through the diet, and I'm gonna put you on a similar one, when I was going through the diet, I would sometimes do 3 or 4 Epsom salt baths in a day. They were so beneficial for me. So you can go by what feels good to yourself, that you can very much go with your intuition. Usually I'm going to tell you, Les, that you are not allowed to listen to your intuition. You're not when it comes to food. Like, you're just not, because right now your intuition is not your own. Your intuition is from those bacterial overgrowths. So your body is going to be like, I needed sourdough toast. I was gonna die if I didn't have sourdough toast. And what it was your bacterial overgrowth was gonna die, and we need that to die. And that is part of you. So it will feel like you are dying. So you can't go with your intuition with food. You've got to clear things with me first, but you can go by your intuition with lifestyle things and with detox for sure.
Hey, no starch. Does that mean like no sugar, like no honey?
Well, it depends. So usually with Lyme, what I like to do is not do honey. There's conditions I do use honey for, but usually with Lyme, the liver is a bit clogged up, and honey is fructose. Fructose gets broken down in the liver. So I usually try to avoid things that are getting broken down in the liver, because I want the body to detox. I don't want to have to give you things to detox, right? I want your body to do its magic with that. So I usually don't do honey. The purpose of it is not torture, I promise you. It is simply biochemistry. These little bacteria have different diets, and you've got to starve them out to re-regulate the microbiome. You don't have to go in and kill them. You've killed enough, right? You don't have to go in and start killing lots of things. But what you do need to do is rebuild and rebalance. And to rebalance, we have to change who's in there. Right now, you most likely have an overgrowth of the opportunistic bacteria, and those guys only eat starch and sugar. So if we keep starch and sugar in your diet, they stay in your body, and we need them to go. Your good bacteria, they'll eat anything. They'll eat protein, fat. They're easygoing. They're like the chill siblings that will eat whatever you put in front of them, right? So they're good to go. You can feed them anything. And the pathogenic, they only eat starch and sugar too. So it's really quite simple. You just pull those out of your diet for a period of time, and then you start to recover. And as you recover, then anywhere from like 3 months to 24 months, sometimes even longer, then you start to bring in very strategic starches, but you want to do so when you're 95% better. You don't want to do it before then. So these bacteria, they can live for different periods of time, and it's better to play it safe with these and get this done and not deal with it anymore than to go for pleasure and eat these things too soon. So it's really, it can be shooting yourself in the foot if at 3 months you're like, I'm gonna eat popcorn kind of thing, or I'm gonna eat a plantain. Not because foods like plantains are bad for you. Obviously people have been eating that for thousands of years. It's that it's not strategic when you have a bacterial imbalance. So perfectly fine when you're in remission, you're healthy, have all the green plantains you want. You can eat the white rice.
So will you send me like an example of...
I'm going to send you so much. You're going to be like, okay. Mary, I'm overwhelmed. So you're going to get plenty. I'm going to send you recipes, meal plan, food list, lifestyle stuff, just in case you're not doing anything. I want to make sure you're doing it all. And so you can check it off and double check that you're doing all of that. And then we'll go from there. So yeah, you're going to be... You can basically just batch cook. And what I recommend for you, especially since you are taking care of others, is to batch cook, because if you always have food available, you're less likely to fall to a lack of willpower. You cannot count on willpower for this. The bacterial overgrowths are very strong with cravings. So you want
to
have
my routine. I mean, I have the will to do, like, I'll do anything. Yeah. I've done crazy, crazy stuff to try. Yeah, I feel like the willpower is a strength that I have.
I think it is too. You wouldn't
if I have it, if I know what to do, I'm willing to do it. If I
so
know
you
that it'll help.
6 months. This protocol I'm going
to
give you.
Wait,
you
what wanna... happened to 3 months? You said no starch 3 months. Now you're going to six.
No. With the nervous system, you have to do six. I said some people can only do three, but you don't want to shoot yourself in the foot with that, because these bacteria can live for 3 months, 6 months, 9, 24. You don't want to go through all of that work and then feed something too early and still be sick.
Do the parasites eat the same stuff? Like, is eating a starch feeding a parasite too?
No, so parasites don't eat our food. They eat us. They eat our tissue. So you can't starve them out. But what you can do is you can make your immune system more strong to where it fights it off with no problem. Really, these parasitic, these Lyme issues that we're having are not something we see in traditional cultures. These tribes I go and see, they don't have any of these issues. When your immune system is strong enough, these are not an issue. If you're having them, really focus on the immune system. It's not a ticket of like finding some long lost herb or some secret treatment or some amazing new drug. It is an issue in getting your body really back in alignment with true nature, and then your body will do the rest of it. So you can't starve out parasites, but you can make yourself strong enough. So 6 months for this reason. You may not have to do it that long. I'll check in with you, and you're welcome to come to my Lyme group if you want. That would be fine. But Lyme always affects the nervous system for most people, especially if it's continuing to like cause issues, or it just caused issue with the nervous system to begin with. The nervous system takes 6 months to regrow. So I always recommend 6 months when you've had Lyme, like do it hardcore. And what I mean by that is, I really do recommend going into full ketosis for this. And I hope you know when I say that, I teach over 41 different diets. I am not dogmatic about this, but there's some benefits about being in ketosis when you've dealt with Lyme. One is that the high fat content really helps you rebuild that immune system. The food of the immune system is saturated fat, and so you can rebuild it a lot faster. Number two is that energy is often an issue. Although your energy is much better, I still see signs of lactic acid, and carbohydrates produce lactic acid when you break them down. So I wouldn't recommend too many ferments for you right now or carbohydrates. It's probably going to be better for you to function mostly off fat, right? You can have plenty of protein. I'll make sure you don't have muscle wasting and your workouts are good. So I'll design it more for like an athlete, that kind of diet for you so that you can get on.
Can I ask one thing? The thiamine concept, is that something to be played with during this or waiting till after the 3 to 6 months?
The thiamine is something we can do immediately if you want. We can also wait. A lot of times what I'll do is wait for most supplements until after a month. 2-6 weeks, because I like to see what the diet does alone. But thiamine is something that the diet's not going to fix. You really can't fix the thiamine deficiency with diet alone. It's really the, I don't want to misspeak, but I can't think of anything else that that is the case for. So if you want to start with that one, I wouldn't hesitate, because that can help with the lactic acid issues. And if we get at those lactic acid issues, you'll probably sleep better and you'll also feel better in general.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is a lot to digest here. let me see if I have, I took a lot of notes here. Let me just see if I have any questions. So in general, and you'll send me more detailed stuff, and hopefully we'll do a follow-up if you're open to it down the road, where we'll go over what that plan was and then what it did for me.
And yes, we should do it at the 3 or 6 month mark.
Maybe you would even field like a few questions from the audience if
you want to go.
I don't want to but you're saying possibly explore the ramp up to a high dose thiamine for, I guess that's a temporary thing, just to kind of get the machinery back up and running.
That's right.
Don't worry so much about the anti-parasitics yet, but that might be in the future at a low periodic dose of a once a week thing.
That's right.
And take out starch, be very strict about that, play with ketosis. And can you said does ketosis help a potential lactic acid issue? Is that what you were alluding to?
Yeah, that's why I really recommend it in this situation. So ketosis has to be done full hog. People that flirt in between, they're really shooting themselves in the foot, because then you don't have an energy system. So you've got to commit to either gluconeogenesis or ketosis. And for Lyme, because of the immune issues, plus the nervous system issues, plus lactic acid issues, it's really best to go into ketosis, but it has to be done properly. I rarely see people do it properly. And so I would definitely get a meter. You need to know if you're actually in ketosis or not.
Can I use the strips? I've explored with ketosis a bunch. Yeah. I feel like I know from when my energy goes like boom, and my I feel like I could tell cognitively when I switch over.
Yeah, you'll know a few tells. One is that your cognition should be extra sharp. You should be satisfied more of the time. So you won't be distracted thinking about food or drinking or anything else. You're kind of just more satisfied and calm. Your feel-good chemicals should be very steady, as should your appetite. Very steady, so not these big ups and downs.
Right.
You should be able to go long periods of time without eating, and you shouldn't wake up to urinate. Those are all signs of being in ketosis proper.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then how do the oxalates play? And do I do like a low oxalate version of ketosis?
Yeah, you don't really have to. I'm going to give you is going to be naturally lower oxalate. Okay. We're not going to use spinach, but we're also not going to use nuts for a very specific reason. And that is that with Lyme, often there's co-infections going on, and nuts have a lot of arginine, which can feed viruses. Also, we're in the middle of a viral epidemic. I don't want you to be prone to that. So I'm going to give you a lower oxalate plan anyway.
Arginine. Arginine?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's called arginine?
Uh-huh.
I thought it was arginine.
It might be colloquial. Yeah. Oh,
okay. Mm-hmm. And that has like, if I recall, like an opposing effect of lysine.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's interesting. I do use those collagen peptides sometimes. I don't want to say sometimes. I use it freaking every day. So those are high in arginine, I think.
Probably. They would have a good amount of lysine as well. But I wouldn't use any powders, mixes, anything while you're doing this.
Can I still drink coffee?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, coffee doesn't mess up the microbiome. So you can. You can have up to 2 cups a day. That's totally fine.
Okay. See, that's the kind of thing I need to hear.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's also like, okay, so some good things. Your mood should be better than ever before by week 6. Like you should really have just kind of like elation coming out of your microbiome. So that's a nice thing. Okay. Also, your body should look like it did in high school. I mean, it sounds like you're pretty fit, but it really carves on its own without you exercising. So you get a lot of benefits from it. For someone more sick with Lyme, it would be brutal in the first month. I think you're going to be fine because you do so well with the baths and the saunas, but don't hold me to it. We'll see how you go. I'll help you along the way and we'll get you through it. But this is what, you know, even if I had tested positive with Lyme and treated and I was fine, I would do this protocol just to make sure I was safe so that I didn't sink back into illness like before. So it's not a bad thing to do as a cleanup. Even if you were in remission, it's still a good thing to do.
Gotcha. Yeah. Mary, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this. For the audience that wants to dive a little deeper on their own journey with your methodology, I know we've said it in your first interview, but could you just reiterate how people could find you?
Sure. So the best thing to do, especially if you're Lyme, you have POTS, dysautonomia, long COVID, you know, this whole umbrella of illnesses. I run a weekly group, and that's my only group I don't require an intake for first. So you can come and join and get the protocols. I have multiple different ones for the different things and different presentations within each diagnosis, and get some support from lots of people that have it. So you can always do that. And that's at enableyourhealing.com. And then you can always check me out on Instagram and YouTube and all of that.
Okay. Enableyourhealing.com would be the easiest way for them to sign up.
I would say so. Yeah, that's my website. So you'll see a lot of what I'm doing there. It's not fancy. I mean, I'm so basic with this stuff. So it's just a Wix website, but you'll see like my Cows for Kids effort. I have some quick start guides because I know lots of us are industrious, right? We've had to be our own doctors. So if you guys want any of the guides, you can go and get it and do it yourself and not even work with me. So that's great for those of you that are industrious. And then, yeah, I've got lots of different support groups and things like that. And I've been enjoying them so much. I know we talked about it last time, but I am just growing more and more fond of these. So I think I'm probably going to come out with more for other conditions. But I started with the dysautonomia, Lyme, and COVID because that's dear to my heart. Right. I feel very inspired to work with that given my history, but I'll probably start ones for histamines and oxalates and all that kind of thing in the future.
Awesome. Well, yeah. Thank you again. Again, I'm very grateful for you taking the time. You know, I like to help others, but this is also a little selfish. I mean, I wanted you a little bit for myself, and I am in the middle of a little struggle that I'm dancing. So I am really grateful that you're here to help. And I hope for the listeners out there that there's something valuable that you could take from this conversation. I want to thank the listeners for tuning in and for listening. And if you have questions, shoot them our way. And if I have any trouble answering it, I'll see if I can get Mary to answer your questions. And hopefully she'll be back on in a few months to do a follow-up and maybe an opportunity to ask her directly a question.
Yes, which means you have to be compliant. We're going to do this properly. And yes, and if anything comes up, just let me know. I'm going to type all this up and get it to you by tomorrow. Some things we didn't have time to talk about. So if you have any questions about what I'm going to send you, just let me know. But overall, it's simple, just hard.
I'm okay with hard. Great. I appreciate it. Again, listeners out there, thanks again. I hope you enjoyed. Stay tuned for more. Everybody out there, have a great day.
Well, thanks again for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I know I did. Mary is just a delight, and I just love talking to her. I could go on for hours. So she gave me a lot of homework, and honestly, it's a little daunting. She does not mess around. She takes it very serious, and it seems like she holds her clients to a very high level of personal responsibility. So I know myself, I've, you know, practiced responsibility and kind of willpower for a long time, but even this looks like it's going to be challenging, and I think I am up for the challenge, and I'm really excited to see what happens. And I will report back to the audience to let you folks know what that protocol was and how it's helped or didn't. Again, thank you for listening. If you know somebody you think would enjoy this episode, please share it. And I hope you stay tuned for more. And don't forget, if you haven't checked out the membership at the Mindful Movement, it's a great way to support the Mindful Movement. It's a lot of fun. And if you have any questions about it, just shoot us an email and we'll see if it's a good fit for you. Have a great day.